Hello and welcome to Behind the News, here at a new time slot on KPFA. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Three guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report on the right-wing patrons who made Newark Mayor Cory Booker famous. And then two guests commenting on the disastrous recall election in Wisconsin. John Nichols of The Nation gives details on how a popular movement was derailed into a depressing electoral campaign. And Sam Gindin, now an academic, but before that a union guy for more than 20 years, on the dismal state of organized labor as revealed by the Wisconsin debacle. First up, Glenn Ford. Glenn is a veteran radio and print journalist who is now executive editor of the fine webzine The Black Agenda Report. A couple of weeks ago, Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, drew attention for his vigorous defense of Bain Capital against Democratic attacks. Some people wondered why a Dem would come to a private equity firm's defense, apparently not aware of Booker's closeness to Wall Street interests. Even less well-known than that are Booker's ties to the moneyed right, entities like the Bradley Foundation and the Manhattan Institute. Here's Glenn Ford with the details. Welcome, Glenn. Some people were surprised by the vigor of Cory Booker's defense of Bain Capital. You weren't. Why not?
Because Cory Booker has uniquely close ties, not just to your usual garden variety of Wall Street denizen, but to some of the most reactionary capital in the United States. His career was basically nurtured by the Bradley Foundation out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is one of the queen bees of the vast right-wing conspiracy that does exist.
Could you give us some detail on history? How did they get together, and how have they greased his rise to prominence?
Well, Cory Booker was just a one-term city councilman in 1998 in Newark, New Jersey. Not well known, not thought of as a mover and shaker, but made something a local stir in politics by having his coming out party, so to speak, at a power luncheon that was organized by the Manhattan Institute. Everyone who understands the right-wing constellation knows that through their division of labor, the Manhattan Institute is on point for all things media, maybe because of its location in Manhattan. But their power lunches are the signals to the brethren in the right-wing networks that whoever is the star is one of them. So it's a kind of coming out party. And Cory Booker wound up making his national debut at the Manhattan Institute's power luncheon. I remember when that happened, and of course I understood that Cory Booker was on record in favor of school vouchers for private schools, that he'd purposely picked fights with the teachers' union, and that he was, without question, the most right-wing member of the Newark City Council. But I didn't realize how well-placed he was until in 2002, Cory Booker made his first run for mayor of Newark, New Jersey. And it was through the process of that campaign that we discovered that Cory Booker had, in fact, been entangled through his support for school vouchers with the Bradley Foundation and the Heritage Foundation and related right-wing money bags for a number of years. That Cory Booker was part of an organization called the Black Alliance for Educational Options, which was pulled together by the Bradley Foundation, an organization, I guess you would have to call it an AstroTurf black organization, built out of whole cloth to give the impression that black people were demanding school vouchers for private schools, that there was an organic upswelling of support in black America for charter schools, that all of these issues that had never before in the history of black America been black issues, That is, black people never demonstrated for school vouchers. Black people, certainly in the 90s, never had demanded that there be expansion of charter schools. But that somehow this was growing organically out of the black polity. It was all a concoction of the Bradley Foundation, which spent $2 million on the initial organizing conference of the Black Alliance for Educational Options. Cory Booker was there, along with a whole bunch of right-wing folks from New Jersey and across the nation. He was one of the original board members of the BAEO. The Bradley Foundation, by then joined by Heritage and the rest of the money bags of the corporate right, then spent another several million dollars with a national coming out party for the Black Alliance for Educational Options, a 10-city media tour that convinced the corporate media that indeed there was some kind of black grassroots demand for what soon came to be called reforms of the public school system. Cory Booker was deep in the heart of that concocted astroturf battle that the corporate right was waging to, for the first time, plant their own candidates, their own right-wing black candidates in races in the inner cities. It became clear that instead of backing black Republicans, and there have not been a black Republican elected to a black majority black congressional district in the United States since 1935, and instead of pushing for black academics, subsidizing chairs for them in various universities and then paying for their book tours and using them to get the right-wing worldview out there through black lips, that was never very effective. They would plunge deeply and directly into black politics in places like Newark. And Cory Booker was part of that first wave in 2002. He was barely defeated by us in that year, but those same forces had two very important victories, and that is the defeat in 2002 of Earl Hilliard by an obscure black prosecutor in the Black Belt of Alabama, and the defeat of Cynthia McKinney in Atlanta, Georgia. The same political forces and the same financiers were behind those two defeats as backed Cory Booker to the tune of at least four, possibly $7 million in his first unsuccessful race for mayor of Newark.
And now, with Romney apparently embracing vouchers as the core of his educational policy, so far the Democratic Party, while it's taken on a lot of the testing and charter agenda, has shied away from embracing vouchers at a national level. Do you think that this may change given the cultivation of the likes of Booker?
You know, President Obama has been careful not to say any kind words about vouchers, but he's also been very careful not to attack them directly if he could avoid it. And the reason is that the same folks who back charter schools, and this administration is a mafia for charter schools. Those same forces, many of them, also back vouchers for private schools, and so in some areas these forces are commingled, and that's why Obama and other pro-charter Democrats have been muting their critique of school vouchers. That tends to get them in trouble. Some of the people who are steadfast supporters of them when it comes to charters are also deeply involved in the voucher movement. So I would expect that if he can, the president and other prominent Democrats will try to avoid having to take a firm position against vouchers.
That was Glenn Ford, executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. The Black Agenda Report is a very fine thing, and if you don't follow it, please do check it out. BlackAgendaReport.com. And now on to Wisconsin specifically and the state of the labor movement generally. First, we've got John Nichols of The Nation magazine. John grew up in Wisconsin and lives in Madison. He's the author of many books, most recently Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest. I wondered how the great popular upsurge that began in February 2011 with the occupation of the state capitol building ended in a dismal electoral campaign. Here's John Nichols to tell us how. Welcome, John. So how did the great popular upsurge of Madison that began in February of 2011 end up as what turned out to be a doomed electoral campaign?
I think that the first thing to understand is that the electoral impulse was always there. And that's one of the challenges of contemporary movement politics. Even in the initial days, when the folks were marching around the Capitol and it was first being occupied, you started to see recall signs. And part of the reason for that is that the recall is a very, very commonly practiced procedure in Wisconsin. It's been used many, many times in local elections, sometimes in legislative. And so people defaulted to it as a vehicle to get rid of a governor they didn't like. And that was great. That's renegade politics. There's nothing wrong with that, because the recall is actually an old school progressive tool used to kind of break the electoral cycle as the politicians use it. So at that point, it was a very positive thing, and the talk of recall was very, very threatening to Walker. The tragedy came once the recall became a reality, as real mass movement and literally tens of thousands of people went out, worked like crazy to get this fight on the ballot. You could see a transformation almost immediately from grassroots, very energetic, clenched fist in the air, you know, out in the cold, ready to march, into a standardized political campaign. And you saw the consultants come in, you saw the advertising, you saw the fundraising. And the crisis there is that this movement politics cannot naturally translate into our almost fully corrupted contemporary politics. So you saw a clash of ideals with a political model that is, you know, not designed in any way to take it in. And an awful lot of movement people, grassroots folks, threw in with the recall passionately, backed it, campaigned for it, because they presumed that the quote-unquote professionals, the Democratic Party folks, some of the union folks, knew what they were doing. But again, the professionals didn't know how to translate this thing to electoral politics either, whereas the Walker folks, with their immense amounts of money and their really quite brilliant messaging up front, very messaging that made a small d democratic process, recalling, forcing an elected official from office, into something that people imagined as anti-democratic. All of that worked all too well. And at the end of the day, you had this very idealistic, very popular uprising translated into a very traditional, almost drab election campaign. And the place where I saw it writ most large, that I hadn't laughed about anything in the last, you know, couple months. You know, laughed about personal things, but nothing as regards the campaign. And the thing about the movement, the uprising of a year and a half ago, was that it was consistently funny and high-spirited. It had a dark humor to it, but also a light humor. And when you take that away and try to translate into contemporary politics, it just didn't happen. That's the painful reality of a clash between movement politics and electoral politics.
And what role did the union leadership play in pushing things in that direction?
The reality is that most, not all, and I want to emphasize, there really are distinctions within the union, but most union leaders in Wisconsin, and I think nationally, tend to think about crisis situations, challenging situations involving their future, how they're structured, how they function, as political questions. And so their default position quite often is to say, well, let's find an election we can win. And they also place great trust in the consultants and the strategists. And so you saw a lot of union leaders saying, this is great. Let's go to the recall. Let's get rid of Walker. And then we can change the laws we don't like. We can change the structural things we don't like once we're in that position. Now, that's not the whole of the union movement. There was always folks who said, you know, look, we have to be very careful not to diminish this movement, what's going on at the grassroots. It was striking that the union National Nurses United came in early on with a very strong blame Wall Street message and very strong economic messaging, far less focused in on the electoral, far more focused in on kind of the organizing people to keep talking about core economics. There were other unions on the ground that did that as well. The Teaching Assistants Association, which in many ways was the first group that was out on behalf of the uprising back in February of 2011, did not endorse in the recall. Obviously, they thought the Democrat was a little better than the Republican, but that the Democrat was insufficiently committed to a renewal of labor. There was twists and turns, but at upper-level leadership, there was a lot of buy-in for the recall, and I don't think it was an evil buy-in. I don't think it was any kind of desire to undermine the uprising. It was more to go to the default position, and this becomes the great new challenge for people to learn a few things. I mean, elections and political fights are always instructive. You either learn something from it or you repeat it. And I think the thing that has to be learned is that the Democratic Party, as it's currently constructed, certainly has people within it who believe strongly in labor rights and are ready to do the big fights. But the elite of the Democratic Party is disinclined toward that. And we all know why. I mean, obviously, an immense amount of money raised off Wall Street, a sense that, quote-unquote, labor will be with us no matter what we do. And so the Democratic Party tends to take labor for granted. As long as that dynamic remains in play, and as long as labor takes for granted that the Democratic Party will know what to do, it's a dysfunctional relationship. Because labor politics, labor movement activism, doesn't naturally translate to a political, electoral politics model in which you have very softened, very dumbed-down messaging, not a very instructive or not a teaching moment messaging, but rather, you know, your opponent's awful and then some soft issues. That doesn't work for when you're trying to build out any kind of people's movement, any kind of grassroots movement. I think there's got to be a lot of rethinking. I write about this a lot. I wrote a book on the Wisconsin uprising. I wrote it before things shifted toward electoral. And so there's only a small portion of the book that actually looks at the electoral side, because I thought the movement itself was so vital, so exciting, and that we shouldn't lose touch with that. But in the electoral section, I did talk a good deal about this challenge of making the party that is supposedly the vehicle of working class into just that. In the 30s, where you saw some movement in the Democratic Party toward actually championing unions, working class issues, working class concerns, the thing that so many historians miss out on or lose sight of is that there were independent left parties that existed as viable threats to the Democratic Party. You had the Progressive Party in Wisconsin, the Nonpartisan League in North Dakota, the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, the American Labor Party in New York City and New York State. All of these groupings, as well as socialist groupings, actually doing very, very well at the municipal level, they were threats to the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party didn't move toward a deeper politics, it would lose. It would lose a lot of its working class base to these alternatives. And so Roosevelt recognized that early on and made a conscious choice to play to the left, especially in these northern industrial states. Without an alternative pressuring Democratic leaders today in the same way, I don't see easy routes to make electoral work for, you know, really genuine grassroots movement. Yeah, in a democracy, you'd like to figure out how to win power and do things. But, you know, I don't think we should lie to ourselves about how hard that is, especially when you have the disproportionality of money in politics. And frankly, when you have the disproportionality of messaging in politics, the right is very, very affirmative, very, very aggressive in its messaging. At this point, the Democratic Party is very, very soft, and so much of its messaging is, we're just not the Republicans. And people think, oh, that's great, you know. But that isn't exactly something that gets people to cross the street and go to vote. Democratic messaging so often is, vote for us because we'll stop the really bad guys from doing really bad things, but there's very little of, vote for us because we want to do really good things.
That was John Nichols, who, besides being a reporter for The Nation, lives in Madison, Wisconsin. His most recent book is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk with Sam Gindin about the state of the labor movement. Hint, it's not so good.
To me, I never wanted to.
That was some of the Wanderlust, or Wanderlust for those of you who say München, from the new album by Metric. I love the way Lou Reed's snarly voice sounds there with Emily Haynes' liltier one. After Scott Walker's victory in Wisconsin, I wrote several pieces in my so-called blog, lbo-news.com, about the disaster. Here's the Reader's Digest version of what I said. While the gusher of money in support of Walker mattered, lingering on the money explanation is just too easy. Instead, several issues must be confronted. One was the horrible mistake of channeling a popular uprising into electoral politics. Such campaigns always dissolve everything into mush, while the right remains vicious, crafty, and uncompromising. Guess who always wins that sort of confrontation? And, as much as it hurts to admit this, labor unions just aren't very popular. In Gallup's annual poll on confidence in institutions, unions score close to the bottom of the list, barely above big business and HMOs, but just behind banks. Far more Americans would like to see unions have less influence than have more. Despite a dismal job market, approval of unions is close to an all-time low in the 75 years that Gallup has been asking the question. A major reason for this is that twice as many people think that unions help mostly their members as think they help the broader population. A major reason for the perception that unions mostly help insiders is that it's all too true. Though unions help out in things like living wage campaigns, they're all too interested in their own wages and benefits and not in the needs of the broader working class. Public sector workers, for example, rarely make common cause with the consumers of public services. Since 2000, unions have given over $700 million to Democratic candidates. What do they have to show for it? Imagine if they'd spent that sort of money, say, lobbying for single payer, day in, day out, everywhere. Like it or not, the whole model of American unionism, in which unions were given exclusive rights to bargain over contracts in closed shops, is somewhere between terminal and already dead. Collective bargaining has mostly disappeared in the private sector and now looks doomed in the public sector. That means if unions ever want to turn things around, and I think that's actually important that they do, they have to learn to operate in this new reality, which means learning to act politically, to agitate on behalf of the entire working class and not just a privileged subset with membership cards. After I wrote a longer version of these comments, I got a lot of reactions via email and social media. Much of the reaction was very positive, including from union people. But there are also some harsh complaints. My favorite is that I just wasn't aware of all the door-knocking and retail campaigning that union forces were doing over the last few months. But a few months of that isn't enough. I'm talking about years of education, organization, occupation. Face-to-face talk, direct action, all manner of things. And another thing, a pervasive macho tendency in union culture to dismiss anyone who isn't in the trenches as an ivory tower pansy. Outside analysts just don't know all the great work they're doing. Well, you know, it's really not working out so well. So maybe all that time in the trenches just leaves you with a mouthful of dirt. Okay, my next guest is the excellent Sam Gindin. Sam is an economist who spent more than 25 years with the Canadian Auto Workers Union, first as a researcher and then as advisor to the president. He retired from the CAW in 2000 and has since been teaching in the wonderful political science department at York University in Toronto. He frequently collaborates with another Behind the News favorite, Leo Panitch. The debacle in Wisconsin is deeply symptomatic of the crisis in American labor, and there's no smarter commentator on that topic than Sam Gindin, even though he lives north of the 49th parallel. Sam Gindin. Welcome, Sam. The defeat of the Walker recall in Wisconsin has certainly prompted some reflections on the state of the labor movement. What are your initial thoughts on that? I know you're across the border in Canada, but it certainly has repercussions across North America.
I'm interested for the same reasons that everybody else is interested in, and has repercussions here. And I've also, my wife's family is in Wisconsin, so we've been in touch with them. The main thing, I think, is that, you know, I think it's a point that you've made. We really have to take a look at what happened and ask ourselves some hard questions. I'm sympathetic to people who feel like Walker won the election through the amount of money he put in. We have to try to defend the labor movement through this. We have to hope that people don't get demoralized. But the real thing we have to do is be honest about what's happened. And being honest means talking about the real serious crisis in the labor movement. And it's a crisis that's actually been there for at least a quarter of a century. And it was especially evident when the financial crisis happened. And instead of being able to go on the offensive, labor was on the defensive. And it was revealed again with Occupy, when the labor movement supported Occupy, but what was really called for was the question of labor showing that it can occupy things and that it had the power to do things. So this is a serious crisis, and I think we really have to be honest and step back and address the seriousness of the crisis. We have to stop talking about just the economic crisis and just how bad the right wing is when it does all the things we expected them to do, and actually have that kind of a discussion about the labor movement.
And how similar are things in Canada to the U.S.? I mean, a lot of people will say this is an American issue, American problem. You got American individualism, the brutality of American repression throughout the course of the last century or so.
I'd argue that, of course, there's different nuances in Canada. In some ways, the attack hasn't been as aggressive. Canada doesn't play the same imperial role that the United States plays, and that leads to some differences. But the fact of the matter is that the differences are not that great in Canada, and if anything, we've been kind of converging to that same notion of limited options, and there's nothing that you can do about this, and lowering our expectations so that whatever happens, it could have been worse, or, you know, the Democrats may, you know, you have to make a choice between whoever is worse and whoever is worser. So I don't think that the differences are that great here, and I'd even go further. I don't think that the differences are that great generally in Europe, except for some of the places like Greece, where there's been a particular kind of resistance because of how much they've been attacked. But I think there's a general crisis in the trade union movement everywhere. And I think we should talk a little bit more about what is it exactly, but I think it's also wrapped up with the question of a crisis on the left, which is an integral part of this.
Some of the criticisms I've gotten for some of the things I've written is that, first of all, not having been an organizer myself, I don't understand how difficult things are. I think I do understand how difficult things are. But the other thing is that there's some people who seem to think that all we need to do is keep doing the same thing with increased dedication and intensity. What do you think? Is that good? Is that the way out of the crisis?
No, that's part of the problem. And again, I respect everybody who's feeling like they're put on and it's difficult and workers have immediate struggles. But, you know, seeing this as a problem of let's just plug on, let's do this a little bit more, let's just be a little bit more committed. I mean, if there's anything we should have learned is that that doesn't get us anywhere. This is a really serious radical problem. Let me just say what I think it is and what we have to talk about. And I think there's a problem in unions that in their very formation, they were sectional organizations. That the essence of unions is that you're defending a group of workers. You're not actually thinking about the class as a whole, and not even about other dimensions of workers' lives. And on occasion, in spite of that sectionalism, you see the potential of workers because they go beyond it, as they did when they were mobilizing in Madison. But the problem is that the structures of unions and their culture and their logic take them back to returning to being very instrumental. I mean, the problem with being sectional and just thinking about yourself is you also tend to think instrumentally. You look to your leaders as you pay some insurance for being in the union, you give them some dues, and they'll deliver. And the leaders think in terms of, well, we occasionally have to mobilize the workers, but we shouldn't, exaggerate that or really open the door to mass mobilization because we just want to mobilize them enough to make a deal. And that problem, I think, is fundamental to what we're seeing into this crisis. And after the war, this wasn't obvious because after the war, you could in fact make gains by being sectional. And in fact, some of those gains would spread to others. The defeat after the war was the defeat of the left inside unions. And part of that was promising people that, well, you can just win things within capitalism and just being instrumental. And you don't really need a left. And people, a lot of workers accepted that. And when neoliberalism came, in the absence of a wider vision, in the absence of a left, that sectionalism was dead. You just couldn't make gains when you're facing not just an employer, but you're facing the state, then you're facing the employer in an entirely different context. And I don't think the trade union movement ever came to grips with that fact. I think they stumbled on doing partly what you just raised. Well, we'll just have to try harder. This is cyclical. It'll get a little bit better. Maybe we'll elect somebody else. They didn't realize that whole era was over, and unions really had to reinvent themselves. And what the financial crisis raised was here was the biggest crisis we've seen since the 30s. And in the 30s, unions at least had recognized the limits of craft unionism and developed a new organizational form in terms of industrial unionism. And I think the question that was being posed by the financial crisis this time is, okay, what are you going to do this time? What is the new organizational form that workers might come up with, given that the organizational form that they have, the sectional unionism, isn't capable of doing it, given that public sector unions can say, we'll take out billboards to say we support the public sector, but nobody really believes them. They see it as opportunist. So there's this real question of what might a different unionism mean? And I don't think people who are trying to defend unions by saying they're okay, don't attack them, just plug along, are actually doing the unions any favor. I think what really needs to be done is we have to challenge unions. And I think that was the excellent part of what you were writing about.
And there's a perception in the broad public that unions are really mostly interested in themselves. The leaders seem to be very interested in their own salaries and perks, too. But it seems that the leadership thinks that its product, it has a product to sell. That product is a contract and certain privileges in wages and benefits. And that seems to foster a perception among the broad public that unions just don't care about the working class as a whole. And is that a fair perception on the part of the public?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, you know, if you tested the unions, compared to the ruling class, to other sections of society, they might in fact be more progressive on these issues. But the reality is that it's not enough. It's not enough that unions might, in general, their members might, in general, vote more progressively or they might care more about these things. Unions have to prove it. And you don't prove it by passing good resolutions and even donating some money to good causes or putting up billboards that say we support public services. Unions have to prove it, and to prove it, they have to be radically different. So, for example, they have to consider when we're in bargaining, maybe we actually have to put the quality and level and administration of services on the bargaining table. Unions don't do that. In other words, we would actually be ready to strike for something that we consider a fundamental right in society. We're actually willing to do that. Now, when you start doing that, you have to educate your members differently. You have to change all your structures. Your research has to be different. How you mobilize and organize has to be different. But, starting to think about that would mean a radical change and a chance to actually win the public over. And when I say win the public over, I actually include other unions who are also skeptical of this, who see this as well. They just want to raise their wages, and that means raising my taxes. So you've got to win people over, and it means you have to develop a class perspective. You have to be driven by a class perspective. You can't say we're organizing, but the point of organizing is we want to just get more dues, because that affects, what kind of commitment you have, what kind of energy you put into it, whether you're going to cooperate with other unions to organize people, even if you don't get them. So if you have a class perspective, you'd have a different take on unionization. You have to deal with this question of, hey, wait a second, we're saying that we support the public, but then we go on strike and take away the service. Isn't that a contradiction? So you have to start thinking about, well, maybe we have to do other things so that when we really go out on a full-scale strike, people will get it. And by other things, I mean such as if it's a garbage strike and they're asking you to drop the garbage off in a park while the strike is on, maybe you drop it off on Wall Street because you want to make a connection between austerity and the strike. Maybe you actually think about, we're not going to pick up garbage in rich neighborhoods because we want to make that connection. And we've had examples of workers coming up with that sporadically, but the problem is that's only sporadic. It has to get to what the organization is actually about. Now, I should say, I think I don't know that you can transform unions as they are to being more than that, but I think what we need, I've been trying to think through what it might mean to think about an intermediate organization. And by an intermediate organization, I mean something that would be a new form of working class organization that would see workers as joining them, linking them across unions, having networks of activists across unions. So it isn't just a union with its sectional interest, but it's workers joining something because they see it as a class interest, and that it also expresses all the other dimensions of their lives. So it's linked to the community. So it's not a political party, but it is explicitly trying to take on the question of class and educate around the fact that unions face systemic problems that are more than facing a particular employer.
What do you make of the fact that something like a third of union members voted for Walker?
Well, I think there's a division between the public and the private, which is part of that, with people being won over to isolating the public sector. But it completely reflects the fact that if unions are only instrumental sectionalist organizations, and then people are voting on the basis of, does this help me in particular, even if it screws other workers? No sense of, if you're screwing other workers, how they might come back to bite you in the longer term, the longer term perspective. If you kind of accept the fact that, well, look, in practical terms, I do want to support business because the only model we have for growth and therefore financing public services is to support business, then workers can make a very sensible and rational decision that this is best for me, given that there's actually no alternative. No one's talking about challenging business. No one's talking about, an alternative way of creating jobs that isn't even just some stimulus, but is actually thinking about questions of planning and conversion. So I think that as long as people have a limited perspective on how you define the problem, that shouldn't surprise us. And the reality is that workers, unions don't see their role as developing that kind of a broader perspective for the longer term. I guess my argument would be that kind of narrow perspective which worked in the past isn't actually even practical anymore. It's not that you can make an argument that, well, it's practical to just be small. That's what we find out is impractical. You lose your own members. They see the solution and not working. And we have to start thinking bigger and more radically, because that's the only thing that's practical right now. And, that's a revolution inside union. It's a massive cultural change. And I don't think that this can happen without a left that is both inside and outside the unions pushing this kind of a thing and getting unions, even if you don't win them over, but getting them to at least put on their own agenda strategic questions about how should we respond. Well, if you think of the Wisconsin uprising, there should have been some structures formed as this was happening, like assemblies where people were actually discussing, what do we do? How do we get neighbors on side? What do we do when they say this? How do we answer these questions? How do we get, into the high schools and develop people? Because this is going to be, we're talking about another generation that's going to be affected. And when that was ignored and everything just gets channeled into an election, which at this point in time, you're simply operating on their terrain, the end result isn't that surprising, and you're not really building things. And you can also ask the question of, well, what would have happened if unions won? I mean, in these circumstances, even if unions won, it would have been a very important victory in terms of bargaining. But the Democrats would have been there to make sure that you had bargaining, but that you couldn't bargain anything anyways. They would have reinforced that image. I mean, the main thing that the Democrats did in this election was run away from actually speaking about class, defending workers, defending unions, and thinking that you could win just by demonizing the other side. So there wasn't even that kind of education and build-up during the election.
When you say things like this, a lot of union people will say, yeah, that'd be really nice, but we operate under a very severe set of legal constraints. We can get fined, we can go to jail, we can be destroyed. So we just have to operate by some rules that are very much stacked against us. What do you say to that?
Well, part of the problem is people not knowing their own history. Unions didn't come out of people sitting down and practically saying, what are the rules, what are the constraints, and how do we operate within them? They figured out how you actually have to break rules, how you have to change them, how you have to mobilize broader. And, when you look at these problems in very small ways, like if I just walk out of my workplace, I'll be fired. Yeah, you will be fired, so you shouldn't do that. But you should figure out, well, what would we have to do in our workplace so that we're protected because we actually have a mass base? How do we build that base? They showed that in Wisconsin, that they were sitting in parliament and taking over parliament was a massive act of defiance. All the things that we cheer when they happen elsewhere are acts of defiance. Everything about our history was an act of defiance. And, that requires being sober about it. It's not just kind of romantic and let's do it. It actually means saying, what can we do if we can't do certain things now? How do we prepare so that we can do them? But it does mean saying, well, this is the kind of thing, if you want to change things, these are the kind of risks you have to take, and how do we prepare ourselves to take those risks and pull it off? Because if you if you accept the status quo, then the thing you have to remember is that you're not just protecting yourself right now, you're sending a signal to them that they can keep doing it to you. And that's what's been going on for the last quarter of a century. You know, first they lower expectations, then you have the crisis, so now you have to pay for the crisis and bailing out the banks. Now you get defeated. You know, what's going to come out of this Wisconsin thing is that there's going to be further attacks on workers, and workers will be relieved because they weren't as bad as what Walker was promising. I'm talking about in other states. So, you know, the point is this is going to keep going on. It's going to get worse. There's no future in it. There's no future in it for people's kids. People have to start thinking in terms of you have to take a stand, you have to think about what this means, and you have to prepare for it. And it is going to be risky. I think everything that you raise should be, you know, addressed right on instead of pretending that if you do these things, it'll be easy.
And you've also said that the labor movement needs a left, and the decay of the left has really damaged the labor movement. Could you elaborate on that?
It's very difficult for me to imagine unions being transformed completely through their own dynamic. I mean, we haven't seen it happen. We've seen attacks on unions consistently now since the early 80s, and we haven't seen bad times leading to something new. I mean, either people just hope that lower their expectations and hope that if there's a crisis, you just fix it so you can get back to what was normal before, even if that wasn't so great. The leadership have no pressure on them to change. In fact, a lot of them have learned that maybe it's more comfortable to be able to blame big money or globalization or neoliberalism, and that way nobody blames us, so why raise expectations? So the leadership has gotten comfortable, and the membership, it's very hard to rebel when you're looking at the world from one particular workplace. You don't even have connections to others. You know, your leaders are worldly. They travel around. They know what's going on in other places. You're overwhelmed in terms of time. So it's very hard for me to imagine that kind of rebellion. And what a left has to offer is making connections between people across workplaces, bringing in a class analysis so that they see that it's not just them. They can never win if it's just them against the state, but that there's actually a class involved here. Giving them alternatives, giving them some historical memory so they see how workers did this, in fact, in more difficult circumstances in the past. Giving them some comparative analysis of what's going on in Greece and elsewhere. How did people organize? So the left can play that role in terms of bringing a class perspective, resources, memory into the picture. And, you know, and the truth is the left that we have now isn't capable of doing that. So I think one of the questions that comes out of Wisconsin is not just what's wrong with unions, but what kind of a left could actually do that? And the answer to that isn't that we've got to convince workers that the politically right thing to do is to go into the Democratic Party, because that will not develop capacities. In fact, it constrains the development of working class capacities.
Well, I think some practical types would listen to what you just said and say, well, that's all very nice, but, you know, it's too highfalutin. We need some action on the ground and all this stuff about making connections and international comparisons and class analysis is just over-intellectualizing what needs to be, a much more activist approach to the problem. What do you say to that?
Well, at one level, of course, they're right. I mean, it's not, the point of organizing isn't that you phone up a worker and you say, hello, I'm so-and-so, I think we need a revolution and we need a class analysis and can you come and join me? I mean, that's not how people get organized. You do have to be on the ground, but you have to be on the ground in a way that has a class perspective behind it. If you're talking about organizing and you're thinking in terms of class, one of the questions is, if there's so many people being laid off, what are unions doing about their members who are being laid off? If they can't even organize people who are just recently their members, how would you expect them to organize anybody? And the reason they can't organize, they don't do that, is because there's no money in it. There's money in getting new members, but there's no money in helping your members once they stop paying dues. Well, that has to do with the class perspective. And if you have that perspective, it leads to something. You know, it leads to actively organizing the unemployed that were formerly your members. And if you don't do it, that's where you get a lot of the right-wing populist response that you mentioned earlier. Workers say, well, they cared about me when I was paying dues. They don't give a shit anymore. And they end up not being very sympathetic to labor. That's very on the ground. You know, if you're talking about making a breakthrough and organizing home care workers who do exactly the same thing as home care workers in institutions that are unionized do, but they do it privately, you'd probably have to, it's such a massive project, you'd probably have to get cooperation amongst unions. And if you got cooperation, it would be a very on-the-ground, hands-on response to organizing low-paid immigrant women. It's very concrete. But to do that, you'd need this cooperation among unions, and you'd have to actually talk about what kind of a union do you want, where does class fit in, why are you doing this? And if you don't want to talk about that, you won't do it. I mean, you know, that's what we see. You know, the notions of doing this in practical, on-the-ground terms. That's what I consider really idealist. It's not working. This notion of, you know, let's just go out and do it the old way and it's on the ground. Well, you know, you do have to think bigger. And that's part of the role of the left. It's to be a bridge between doing practical, responding to practical and immediate things, but putting them in that kind of a larger context. Because without that larger context, we're losing and we're going to continue to lose. So I think what's really abstract is pretending that these kinds of questions don't matter.
Now, is there really any hope for the future of a model in which, you know, the goal of union activity is organizing a group of workers to get a contract and then have them pay dues for union membership? And this is, you know, pretty much the central model of American unionism. Could this survive another generation, or has this got to go?
Well, I don't know if it has to go. I guess my feeling on it is we need another kind of organization, which doesn't mean this one has to go. It might mean that if we in fact had workers' assemblies and spaces and places where workers actually were mobilizing and organizing around class, that might begin to have an impact on unions. Then, you know, then injecting that into unions might actually demonstrate to unions that you actually need some of this kind of strategic thinking to even be effective at what you're trying to do. So it may be that there's a way of renewing unions, but only because you've actually responded to the times and learned something and said, we need new forms of working class organization. I just got back from Montreal. It's fascinating because, again, it's one of those moments where, in retrospect, you can say, well, this was predictable. There was a lot of student organizing and mobilizing before. But, you know, they've had marches of 300,000 people. They've been fighting around the cost of tuition. Quebec has the lowest cost of tuition in the country, and yet they've been fighting around it because they think it should be a public good that's free. So what recently happened is they began to actually go into neighborhoods, banging pots, and what's happened is neighbors have come out to join them. Nobody would have predicted this. They would have thought they'd be, you know, isolated as spoiled university kids. So first of all, you begin to see that once people begin to see that something's possible, it opens everything. There's people on the street supporting them. There's people in the bars who ran out and joined the demo. But there's all kinds of discussions taking place. People are actually talking about capitalism because they're kind of being forced to as they do this. And then what happened is the students have been running these assemblies, democratic spaces in every university and different in the faculties, to make decisions about where to go and what to do and about tactics. And then this is now being imitated to some extent in some of the communities where people are forming community assemblies to talk about broader issues, not just tuition fees, but the educational system or why there are cutbacks. Well, you know, you begin to see that as struggles take place, you kind of get surprised and things emerge. And then the question is, well, what do you do next to sustain it? So I guess my response is, yeah, you if you're sober, you have to be pessimistic. But there's a quote that's usually attributed to Gramsci. I don't know if he actually said it, but that the challenge is to have no illusions but not get disillusioned. And I think that's the trick. And, you know, it's just one of those historical moments where we have to figure out how to do something. If you think of the period since the Communist Manifesto, it's always been as if there were some answers that somebody had. Unionize, insurrection, form communist parties, form social democratic parties, and it's as if everything has been exposed, and now we have to come up with our own answer because those answers weren't real answers. And so it's very difficult to live through this period because there's no answer on any shelf to take, and we don't have an example abroad to say, why don't we just do it like so-and-so? So it's an incredibly difficult period, but I think that capitalism has really been delegitimated. I don't have any trouble talking to workers, telling them that capitalism is a barrier to human development. They nod their head. They're just not sure how to change it or have confidence in changing it, but it does mean that there's an opening if we can organize and figure out how to take advantage of it. And that's, you know, that's just a difficult challenge. I just think it is crucial that we take our head out of the sand, stop pretending that if we just keep trying and defend workers that things will change. I think that's actually becoming a barrier to change. And I say that with, you know, real respect for the fact that, you know, while you're doing this, of course, all kinds of struggles are going to take place. And, of course, we should support them. But we should also be pointing to their limits.
That was Sam Gindin, longtime staffer with the Canadian Auto Workers, now teaching at York U in Toronto. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from Metric's new album, this Youth Without Youth. Till next week, bye.